Near the start of the 19th century, as the newly established United States looked outward toward the wider world, a group of eminent Protestant ministers formed a grand plan for gathering the rest of mankind into the redemptive fold of Christianity and civilization. Its core element was a special school for heathen youth, drawn from all parts of the earth, including the Pacific Islands, China, India, and increasingly the native nations of North America. If all went well, graduates would return to join similar projects in their respective homelands. For some years, the school prospered, and then stability unraveled. Historian John Demos tells the story in his new book, The Heathen School, a story of hope and betrayal in the age of the early republic. It is a pleasure to welcome John Demos to the Roundtable. John Demos, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you aboard.
Thank you for inviting me on.
How did you come to this particular project of looking at this time?
Well, actually, the beginning of the project is quite unusual, I think. It goes back to a time nearly 20 years ago now when I was visiting a friend, having dinner at a friend's house in Cornwall, Connecticut, standing around in his yard before dinner with gin and tonics in our hands, and one of the neighbors, who was also going to be a dinner guest, began to tell me what he described as a piece of local history, which he thought I might be interested in. I guess I'd been introduced as a history guy, so there we are. And he starts in telling me this story, and I am right away, I'm very intrigued. In fact, I think by the end, I'm just sort of transfixed. It seemed to me it was probably a lot more than just about local history. I came back home to the Berkshires, where I live, thought about it and went to bed that night and couldn't sleep. And the next morning I got up and drove straight to Yale, where I've been teaching for many years, to the library and trying to see if this story was much known or written about. And the answer was not very much. And I sort of took it from there.
And
now we can get into the story itself, but that's the process by which it began.
Yes, and what you have ultimately is the story of a very unique missionary project, and ultimately what it represented for the time and even for us now. What was the scrap that you started with about the project, and where did you go from there?
Well, I was very struck from the start with the way the founders of this project, this school that was especially set up for heathen youth, as they put it, I was very struck by the extraordinary scope and reach of their goals. They thought this was a group of very eminent Protestant ministers, led by the then president of Yale, Reverend Timothy Dwight, a very famous guy at the time. And they thought of this school that they were setting up as a way, as the quickest way imaginable to effect the salvation, as they put it, of the entire world. And by salvation, they meant conversion of heathen, so-called heathen people to Christianity. They meant education. They meant civilized ways of living, as they would have said. The idea was that these young men would be brought from all corners of the earth to the school, and after they graduated, they would return to their various homelands and would start similar projects, churches and schools among their own people, and there would be a kind of multiplier effect here, so that if all went well within a relatively short span of time, some people thought maybe as little as 25 years, the entire world would be converted and, you know, transformed.
Talk a little bit about, as you put it very early on in the book, this crusader mentality and how it ultimately was embraced in the early days of this country.
Well, I think it goes all the way back to the beginnings of American history when Governor John Winthrop led the first band of colonists kind of off the boats in Massachusetts in 1630. He preached the famous sermon, which we encounter these days, often quoted, about how their community would become a city on a hill that all the world would admire, pay attention to, and would use as a kind of model for broad-gauge human improvement. And that idea that this country and we as a people have a sort of redemptive mission for the rest of humankind is has been there ever since, I think. It sort of waxes and wanes, but after the revolution, the American Revolution, the idea was that it took a more kind of secular and political form, that we would become a kind of crusading spirit for force for democracy and republicanism, and, I don't know, bringing it forward closer to our own time, 20th century, First World War. President Woodrow Wilson said it was to make the world safe for democracy. Second World War, make the world safe from totalitarian systems. And I would say, coming quite close to the present, nation building, as we sometimes describe it, overseas, and even some of the recent military adventures or misadventures this country has had, I think they all, to some extent, embody that same redemptive, crusading idea.
And you say yet some of them, in hindsight or even at the time, have a markedly downside look.
Well, I'm not in favor of all of these efforts. It seems to me that some of them have gone badly off the track. I sort of, in my youth, I remember too well the Vietnam War, which I think had some of that same spirit behind it, and which I think was disastrous by most accounts. I was involved in the anti-war movement, so I do have a point of view about something like that. But, you know, I don't want to, the term that often gets kicked around in this connection is American exceptionalism, the idea
right.
that we're exceptional and have something special to give to the world. I don't entirely want to throw that out. I think in some contexts it's been a kind of noble, certainly a well-meaning impulse. I feel that I myself was sort of raised on it. My father was an immigrant from Greece and came here with nothing and had a very successful life. My mother grew up in very humble circumstances across the country on the Pacific coast and again had a different and successful life. And they both would have said only in America could their lives have happened. And it's in some ways that may well be true. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, this idea of American exceptionalism has been sort of in my genes, and I've seen it sort of from both sides, good and bad. And I had always hoped in my work as a historian to find a way to really engage that theme, which I think is so central to our culture. And I hadn't found a way until I heard the story of the school at Cornwall that night some years ago.
One of the other themes of the book and something that you deal with is how we ultimately deal with others who are so different from ourselves.
That's right.
And it's a fascinating look.
Yeah, it's of course a crucial issue. It's a crucial issue for all of us as individuals every day. We confront human difference of all sorts in our everyday lives. But it also has a kind of special kind of public dimension, it seems to me, in the country and culture, this country and our culture, in that human difference, diversity, as we sometimes put it, has been sort of at the heart of American experience, again, from the beginning. If we go back to the colonial period, which actually is the sort of the venue of most of my own work as a historian, in that period, what was absolutely fundamental was the coming together of three great sort of population streams. The Native American people are already here, so to speak, and then come the Europeans, and then increasingly come large numbers of Africans. Well, that three-part stream, as it were, converging in this so-called New World context, was unprecedented in world history. Nowhere else had anything like that happened, and that theme of diversity, we now use words like multiculturalism and so on, has been present all through. We had immigrants coming from all parts of the earth in the 19th century and again, of course, right now. So I can't imagine a bigger theme. And I do think the mission school, the foreign mission school was the official name given to this place, but in an informal way, people referred to it as the heathen school. It was absolutely central. How do we deal with human difference? They had their way, which I think was not very successful. In fact, one of the other things I might say in general about this story I'm trying to tell in the book is that it's a story of failure. There's no getting around that. This was a kind of noble scheme that went wildly awry. But still, they hoped to do something along those lines.
Well,
and, you know, I don't mean to dismiss all their aspirations.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what they were ultimately hoping for, what the goal was, and then ultimately what went wrong to allow it to go awry.
I mean, the goal, to come back to this again, was nothing less than to save the world. That was their language, and it was no metaphor either. They literally meant that. They meant they thought they could transform every human being on the face of the earth to a model that they themselves embraced. I mean, it was a tremendous overreach, in fact, but that was the goal. I think it was sincere. And in a way, it was part of who they were. But it was impossible in practice. And it's clear to me it became clear as I was doing the research for the book, that there were difficulties at this school right from the start. I mean, you know, you're gathering together this wildly different group of people, something like 15 different American Indian tribes and nations represented, and people from Hawaii and other Pacific Islands and China and India, and some European Jews and some Catholics from Central America. It just goes on and on. It was an absolutely unique situation, and I don't think anything like it had ever been seen in American history prior to that time. But it was just too much. I mean, for example, the teachers at the school were just bewildered, it's pretty clear, on how you teach people who have such different backgrounds and such different levels of education already. And there's one quote, which I think is in the book, from one teacher who says, people, they come from so many different regions that we must have almost as many classes as we have students. Well, no wonder.
Mm. So you bring us to 1816 in Cornwall, Connecticut, and you do have to wonder that the same, and this gets back to what you were talking about earlier of that fundamental question of how do we get along with people who are different? And what we consider to be a heathen, that we could almost see this happening today in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, you can. I'm afraid. You know, their answer to the problem of human difference was, we transform them, we change them, we make them like ourselves. But that's a very, very hard thing to do, and I think one can reasonably ask whether it's a morally appropriate thing to do.
And what is the right
thing?
Anyway,
it didn't work. I think today we have a much more nuanced idea about that. Well, I'm not really any authority on modern American life, but it's clear that we try to honor cultural difference in many ways, even as we try to find some common ground for all of the disparate groups of people who make up the American nation these days.
When you were looking into the heathen school and ultimately what happened and what the result is of following what happened to these individuals who are part of it is really fascinating. What were the surprises along the way for you in that regard?
Well, the results of this failed experiment were that most of the students went back to their homelands and basically, as far as I'm concerned, disappeared from view. I could only follow them so far, and usually they just their trail kind of fades out. Which is to say that I think many of them, to coin a phrase, went native again when they went back. They sort of reverted to what they had been and where they had come from. But not in all cases. The two cases that most gripped me and that I knew nothing about really when I started the book are the two young Cherokee men, John Ridge and Elias Boudinot by name, who actually who married local women in Cornwall, and that was a great scandal from the standpoint of most people in this country at that time who did not approve of intermarriage, as they said, at all, racial intermarriage. So these two young Cherokees marry young women from Cornwall. There's a big storm of controversy, which leads to the closing of the school, in fact. They go back to the to their homes in the Cherokee Nation and almost immediately become leaders of their people. At that point, the Cherokees, the central issue for Cherokees is the pressure that they are feeling from white people all around them in Georgia and from the federal government to remove themselves from their traditional homeland there in North Georgia and instead go out west to Oklahoma, to what they then called the Indian Territory. The Cherokees hate this idea, and Ridge and Boudinot actually lead the opposition to removal for several years. They're back and forth to Washington, negotiating with federal officials right up to and including President Andrew Jackson himself. I mean, they're really well-known guys at this point because they're at the forefront of this controversy. But at a certain point, they flip, and they decide that it's not going to work. We're just overmatched against the government and all these white people around us, and we have to accept the necessity of removal, or as they said, emigration. That was the word they preferred. And when they did that flip and took that position, it made them extremely controversial among their own people. In fact, many Cherokees came to regard them as traitors, even to this present day. I think that attitude is fairly common among Cherokee-descended people, Ridge and Boudinot as traitors. But nonetheless, they felt they had to do it. The infamous Treaty of New Echota, which accepted the idea of Cherokee removal, was actually signed in Elias Boudinot's living room, and he and Ridge were its chief promoters. On and on it goes. After they get to Oklahoma, in fact, they are murdered, assassinated by their Cherokee opponents who think of them as having performed this act of betrayal. So that part of the story, and that's the part of the story that sort of connects it to the larger flow of American growth and development. I mean, Cherokee removal, the Trail of Tears, and so on, that's kind of a big deal in the history of this country in the 19th century, and in a sense, connection to the school.
It is a fascinating story. The book is The Heathen School, A Story of Hope and Betrayal in the Age of the Early Republic. The book is published by Knopf. John Damos, thank you so much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Well, again, it's been a pleasure for me. Thanks for having me on.
John Damos will be part of the Booktopia event at Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, on Saturday, April 12th, from 6 to 8:30 p.m. You can find out more at our website, wamc.org/roundtable. Again, the title of the book, The Heathen School. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.